Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and some man that fucking is sceptical about Jose Mourinho, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
That's me.
That was my bot voice, because that is an intro that came directly from Abby's bot, which has gone down incredibly well. Abby, astonishing work. We mentioned it in the last pod. We'll mention it again. So Abby's Twitter handle is Abby Rose Meow. If you want to follow her, she's listed out all of the intros I've given to Nathan and created a bot app that generates new ones. And lots of people have been having fun with this on our Twitter and sending us their favourites. Joyous stuff. Thank you for that, Abby. Once again, Bardi, how is it up on that hill?
It's pretty good. The hordes are massing down the bottom, but I've decided to stay up here for a little bit longer. I don't want to go in. You know, social distancing, I'm not going to go mess with you guys yet. I'm still up here.
So you've laid out your picnic blanket. You've poured a glass of Prosecco. You've got some strawberries on the go. But obviously there's a storm starting, and you can see in the distance that there's some dark clouds brewing. You can see, you know, when you can see the rain from a distance and it hasn't reached you yet. There's something very satisfying about that. But now you also see flashes of lightning, but you're thinking, no, I'm not going to get hit by lightning. I'm fine up here.
I'm like those fishermen in the perfect storm. Nah, it would be all right. We'll just go through it. If we could just get through this storm, there's going to be loads of fish on the other side. And hopefully the boat won't sink. We'll have to see though. Andrea Bell. What was the name of the boat? I think it was called the Andrea Bell or something like that. Hopefully it will stay afloat.
You've got a very good memory for this kind of thing. We're going to try and bring you some light relief in this episode since things are a bit dull. But, I mean, let's not beat about the bush. There will be some misery, too. There will be some abject misery. So if you're up for abject misery punctuated by light relief, then stick with us. Bardi, we released the latest newsletter this week.
Yeah, the fourth newsletter went out. And I said in the intro, it's kind of nice reflecting on Tottenham on a monthly basis rather than like what we have to do a couple times a week, having to dissect a bad result. But because results have been kind of tailing off, I decided to do a trophy-based one because, you know, that's what our manager brings, apparently, trophies. Ewan Flynn wrote a great piece about about the last time we hired a rival manager and how he brought us the League Cup and how that was meant to start a new kind of dawn at Tottenham, but it didn't. So I just thought that really resonated with what's happening to the club now, how we kind of sold our soul back then for a trophy and it didn't lead anywhere and it just put us back in more darkness. And as I was reading that, I remembered the little story of mine about hairdressers and burgers and the 2008 League Cup final. So I thought I'd stick that in there as well. So I'm very happy with that piece. It was really nice to write that on Saturday. But if you want to get the newsletter, you can subscribe to it or just become a patron.
It's really, your piece was lovely. It was It was full of funny memories about working at an exhibition venue and skipping away to go watch Spurs play a cup final.
Yeah, back working in the service industry, you kind of get used to working when everyone else is off, and that was towards the end of my career in the service industry. I'm like, I can't keep missing football because I'm working. I need to get a normal job where 9 to 5 I'm not working. Where on the weekend I'm free to go and watch football. But yeah, it was a great day because we won.
Nice one. So let's do it. We're going to have to do it at some point, so it might as well be now. Let's talk about the Brighton match. As ever, starting with the team selection. Nathan, what were your thoughts when you saw that? Did you sort of breathe a sigh of relief that Toby Alderweireld was back in?
Yeah, it was fine. People are doing a very like a retroactive revisionist. Well, the team selection was terrible. He's picked all the wrong players and he's used them in the wrong formation. It's like, you can have like qualms about Sissoko at right wing back, but like, the lineup was fine. Like, the issue isn't with the 11 players picked. Obviously, you want Kane to be fit, but he's not. But given that, okay, yeah, I think I'd probably have wanted Vinicius to start up top and have a recognised forward with some physicality about him. And maybe we did need Eric Dier. Maybe we don't. But, like, the issue doesn't lie within the choice of formation or the choice of the 11 players, I don't think.
Just to push back on the Vinicius thing a little, I think had Vinicius played more minutes by now, then I would absolutely agree. But given that he'd only played 24 Premier League minutes before yesterday, I was completely happy with him not starting. Just because we don't know what he is yet in the league, and it could have been disaster, but it pretty much was a disaster. But I mean, in my head, I was thinking, just put Bale up front. It's, you know, what's the worst that can happen? He's still got goal mouth instincts. He's very good at playing with his back to goal, as we saw in Nathan's video of him doing so for Real.
Mourinho says that he doesn't want to play up front.
I mean, who cares? You don't let players dictate their favourite positions to you, and that's just it. I mean, it was I sort of said slightly sarcastically in the Discord chat during the match. Actually, there's a nice fluidity to our front line, except for Bale, of course, who only stays on the right. Because it did seem at the start as though Son and Bergwijn were switching quite a bit, and then Bale was literally just like hugging the right touchline. But then he did wander his way across the pitch at times, and there was some fluidity there. I just don't think that is a logical. I don't think you can pick a player to play on the right because he's asked to. I think that's madness. Bardi, what were your thoughts generally on the performance?
I was a bit more concerned about the lineup than Nathan was. I think when playing three at the back, we put a lot of emphasis and a lot of responsibility is put upon our wing backs. And Sissoko, you know, he has his qualities, but he's not a wing back. Davies is a terrible, terrible wing back. And I just think we went up against a Brighton team that are just better at that formation than us. Solly March is a great left wing back. Veltman, although he's not no Lamptey, is pretty decent. And I think it was a mistake to do that. I thought their back three, occasionally they can look a bit ponderous, but I think they proved themselves to be better than ours moving forward with the ball. And the fear for me was just the lack of control we have with Bale and Son. Son is off form. Bale has hardly played. Bergwijn is okay, but he's not gonna hold the ball. He's not gonna link up much play. I was a little bit concerned that there was nothing in that team. And Alderweireld came back, which I know a lot of people have been happy about, but I'm not convinced on him. And I know he made a great save. I didn't actually see the last 5 minutes. My stream died, and I couldn't find another one. So I missed his block. Apparently it was a pretty good one, but. Yeah, but on the goal they scored, once again, I just thought Davies was slow, and I thought Alderweireld did what old defenders do and just started running towards the line and ended up either almost blocking Hugo Lloris instead of being proactive and stepping out and attacking the space, attacking the player and everything else. Yeah, I'm a bit lost with this team, and I'm a bit lost with how we played, and it's a bit of a mess, and I don't see us getting through it by playing wing-backs who aren't wing-backs. And to play Sissoko at right wing-back when you've got a specialised right wing-back on the bench is a weird decision.
If I may counter that slightly, and I don't fully disagree, by the way, but so Brighton's wing-backs were Solly March, primarily a central midfielder for much of his youth, and then as he came through, converted recently to left wing-back, and Joel Veltman, I think it's Joel, pretty sure it's Joel, who's a centre-back, and he was playing right wing-back. So it's kind of like, in some ways, both teams were playing players out of position on left wing. Although I would say March now has adapted incredibly well and now looks like a really competent, very, very good left wing back. But that makes me think it's more than just, there's something more to it than just the wrong players being picked for Spurs. And also, I kind of want to defend Sissoko a little bit, because although I don't think he looks a natural fit for right wing back at all, he did do things that a right wing back would be expected to do, in the sense that he put in some good crosses. He ran with the ball a few times, and it's hard, you know. He's not played right wing back before, other than like filling in a couple of times in the match. And I thought he did okay under the circumstances, but this was a horrible, horrible team performance. I mean, it basically looked like, it, to my eyes, how we've been playing for quite a long time, but with Kane removed, because what we've been doing recently is not playing very well, not really managing games very well, but we've had Kane holding the ball up exceptionally, and we look a threat because he does that and then plays passes for Son over the top. And without that, we just didn't have any attacking thrust.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think our biggest problem is the gaps in the spaces at the moment between Ndombele and Højbjerg. There's acres of room there for people to get involved, and McAllister, Trossard, they pretty much had license to go wherever they wanted on the pitch. I think our biggest problem is, rather than putting more central defenders on the pitch, I think we need to put more central midfielders. Do you know who would be quite useful right now? It'd be Dele Alli, who'd be quite useful in our team. Mm-hmm.
Nathan, you were going to say something then as well.
Yeah, no, I strongly agree with what you're saying about Harry Kane. We have been accused over the years, I think very, very harshly, wrongly, as comically, about being so dependent on Harry Kane. Guardiola misspoke, to be fair to him, and called us the Harry Kane team because he couldn't instantly recall our name on the spot. But we've gone through periods of time, obviously Kane's been out injured on several occasions, we've gone through periods of time where missing Kane has made things rough for us. We've gone through periods of time where missing Kane hasn't stopped us from going on a win streak. But now we truly are the Harry Kane team. Everything we do, what little attacking schemes we have, which is enough to win the football match, but what little scheme we do have, all run through Kane. And without that, we are really, really at a loss. Yeah, we are the Harry Kane team now. I agree with what Wendy says, basically, that this is the same as before, but without Harry Kane. But it's also created sort of a different angle on issues than before. So before, both our strengths and our weaknesses was that, you know, we would get the lead early through some Harry Kane brilliance. And then we would, over the course of the game, maybe too early, or maybe not, we would gradually drop off and look to play on the counter, also through Harry Kane. This is not that. This is something different. In those games, sometimes we would keep our one-goal lead, sometimes we would extend our one-goal lead, sometimes we would forfeit our one-goal lead, and that's where a lot of the concern was. But again, this wasn't that. This was both against Liverpool, both against Brighton, we couldn't get the lead in the first place. We spent so little time this season, so little time this season in a losing position. But now, halfway through the season, we are seeing what it looks like, and it looks fucking awful. And yeah, okay, again, we are missing Kane to sort of make that difference for us in possession, but Jesus Christ, it's rough. It's hopeless. When we don't have the leads, we may as well not be on the pitch.
Yeah, brutal, but but fair. Bardi, what did you think the game plan was from Spurs? Because I mean, if I'm completely honest, I couldn't tell what the plan was.
I saw
a few bits of attempted pressing, but it seemed so uncoordinated. It literally seemed coordinated by someone on the touchline shouting press. That was the level to which I understood the pressing to be organised. But Barney, talk us through what you thought the game plan was. What can you take away from it?
I mean, by putting on Bale instead of Vinicius, you're essentially setting up to counter, because I don't see any other way of us playing with a forward line that's meant to be that explosive. I guess they were hoping somebody would produce a moment of magic, but Bale looks like he's had his soul sucked from his body. He's unable to do anything. A few times he cut inside on his left, and you're just willing him to muster up the determination to at least smack one, but he didn't do that. Son did a couple of runs. Bergwijn hit a shot which was so bereft of confidence. It was embarrassing. I felt sorry for him, and that was the sum of our attacking play. I think we're missing Reguilón something hard. We really, really miss him. His influence, his speed, and dynamism is something that we can't replace with Davies. And weirdly, we're also missing Serge Aurier, because at least he offers us something a bit more, and then we could put Sissoko back in the middle. But I think personally we're missing a midfield right now. I'd rather remove one striker and even put Winks in there to try and give us a little bit of control. And against Liverpool, we had moments of flashes of a bit of quality when we had an extra body in there. At the moment, we're just too open. We're too open, and the gaps between our whole team is too much. I don't know how Mourinho fixes this. I really don't know. I think we're going to go into a phase now against Chelsea where we're going to pretty much, I think the tactic will be hope. We hope to get something. We hope something happens, and we hope to keep it tight, because Nathan's right. Whenever we go a goal behind, it becomes this weird kind of haymaker boxing match where we're just swinging at teams, but we don't have it. We don't have any strength to punch, to knock anybody out. And if anything, we just open ourselves up even more.
There's just no sort of structure or methodology there that I can note. So Brighton did this thing frequently, which I really enjoyed watching, but it just made me sort of think,
I did not.
Why can't we have this? Why can't we have what they're doing? And that was, so they had Veltman, Trossard, and Pascal Gross, who would do this sort of clockwise rotation out on the right. One would make a darting run to drag a player out. The other would then fill that space and make themselves available to receive a pass. And then Veltman would happily come inside to become one or the other of those players doing those things. And what that meant was they constantly had a player in the move. They constantly had an option. They constantly had the beating, therefore, of Ben Davies, who was kind of hung out to dry out on the left a little bit. And they created loads of half opportunities from that space. They looked a real threat, I thought. I mean, I thought Brighton were pretty good when we last played them. And there was some controversy around their goal, the Lamptey goal. It was Lamptey, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. I thought they played pretty well in that game, but they were playing even better. And of course, we were playing quite a lot worse as well. But I was watching them thinking, our players from 1 to 11 are probably better than their players. I mean, maybe not all of the 11, but the majority are better, and yet they just looked a better team. It looked a better unit. It looked more organised.
Sorry to jump in, but you touched on something there, which occurred to me during the game. Is watch how many times a Tottenham player gets the ball, and then look how alone they are.
Yeah,
they're always
it's
by themselves.
It's a real problem.
Yeah, and then you see a Brighton player, and you're right. They have two passing options. At Tottenham, it seems Son gets the ball, and he has to beat two men before something opens up. Bergwijn the same, Sissoko the same. The amount of times Lucas is a master at finding just nobody. So we would get the ball, we would attack, and then the head comes up, and we've either filled the box and the wide player is just all on his own. I'd love Nathan to do a video on this, of just the loneliness of being a Spurs player. There's no one around.
Well, I have a theory that this is why Bergwijn's suffering so much, because he's a player that likes to have lots of neat interplay in small areas to try and get the better of the opponents spatially. And he's just not getting that. He's left to his own devices to try and work space from nothing, essentially. And it's tough. He's struggling.
One thing that is was frustrating me, especially in the Brighton game. Actually, let me give some tactical context here. In both the last two games, we started in a back three. Jose is liking the back three right now because it means that there are enough players behind Ndombele that he feels he can play Ndombele in a deeper role. So both games, we start in the back three, and Ndombele gets on the ball loads. We managed to move the ball into the final third. Not brilliant in the final third, but at least we're getting it through the middle of the park at least some of the time. Second half against Liverpool, we move to a 4-2-3-1, and Ndombele moves to be the 10, and thus ends our involvement in the game entirely. Second half against Brighton, we move to a 4-3-1, but this time Ndombele remains deep, therefore being sort of the most attacking 11 we've seen under Jose Mourinho, essentially. And again, we're getting the ball towards the final third, into, you know, towards the fullbacks out wide, but just not clicking in the final phase of the attack. Lots of reasons for that, too much to sort of really break down, but one trend that is bothering me is Ndombele keeps going into the box to be a target, and it's like, no, we need someone to receive the short pass from the fullback and play the incisive pass to a runner. He keeps, I don't know, he wants a goal, he wants to be a target, he wants to just overload the box, but yeah, we need more direction, more planning about who keeps themselves open and tries to connect things together. Because yeah, maybe it's just a matter of the desperation and the circumstances, maybe the will to be attacking, but we just, yeah, loads the box with, you know, five Spurs players matched by seven Brighton players, and then, well, okay, but who's getting the ball to the player? Like, who's knitting things together? And yeah, as you say, we end up with a wing back being face down and having very little in the way of the back option, and they pass, you know, to the central centre back or all the way to the keeper, and the whole attack has to try and reset, and by then, in this case, Brighton moves about and gets playing back to the keeper, and everything just falls apart. So I definitely, the bigger issue is like a complete lack of possessional structure. But there is definitely a thing with Ndombele running away from the ball in the attacking third. I don't get it.
I have a feeling that this might get worse. one of my theories is that what we might try and do is go back to the lopsided fullback shape. And in doing that, we might start Vinicius with the intention that Aurier, if he's welcomed back into the fold, or Matt Doherty, plays really high as the right fullback. Ben sure. Davies then tucks in as the sort of more defensive left fullback, and we just pull the ball as much as possible over to the right, high up the pitch, and Doherty or Aurier swing crosses in, and we have as many targets in the box as possible. I think that's what we might go to in the short term as a potential solution, which might mean you see more of Ndombele getting into the box and trying to get on the end of things, Nathan, I'm afraid.
Sweet.
I could be wrong.
And we no, had lots. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a very reasonable guess at how things might go.
It's because we've seen it before, right? That's one of his solutions. And again, it was kind of at our low ebb. That's what we implemented to try and build something out of a low point. And we had loads of questions about Ben Davies. Loads of questions about Ben Davies. So if I just go through a handful, Jeff Fieldsend, who was messaging through our website, theextrainge.co.uk, Jeff said, if we want to set up like the Welsh defence, why don't we do it properly? And he basically said, look, for Wales, Davies plays on the left of the three, Roden's in the centre. Davies in particular is a natural defender and not a wing-back like Reguilon, and offers little going forward. The Brighton goal came about because they exploited the gap between him and Roden, and there was an obvious lack of understanding between them. What did you think of that, Bardi? Did you think that was something in that it didn't feel natural for both of them to sort of be shifted along one in their position?
No, I think we should have started with a back four. I just think with no Reguilon, there's nobody that can play left wing back. We tried Doherty and that was a mess. I don't think Davies can play that role anymore. I mean, he's only 27. I couldn't believe how young he is. He's been around for a long time. I put out a little tweet about, I think Davies kind of sums up our stagnation in defence, that here's a guy who he's okay, you know, but he's not really he's getting minutes at left-sided centre-back. He's getting minutes at wing-back, minutes at left-back. He's not really the type of defender you need if you do want to challenge for the title, at least Champions League. I would have played him at left back because he's less incompetent at left back. He can sit there and be reasonably solid. I don't understand why we're playing players out of position. It doesn't work like that. It's never, at least go back, make it simple. Make football as simple as possible if you've got idiot football players. And I thought that's what Mourinho does, and he seemed to do that for quite some time, that we would play idiot-proof football. We would sit deep and play on the counter because we had players who could do that. But now, all of a sudden, we seem to be trying something different and something which doesn't suit our players.
Going back to your tweet thread about Davis, Timmy, one of our ex-subs, said, can Bardi elaborate on Ben Davis's bland food choices? Who else on the team eats boiled chicken?
Well, it was because there was that moment in All or Nothing where you see Ben Davies, he just sat there in the canteen and you can see he's got boiled chicken and veg. And it just sums him up. He's just not very interesting, not very exciting. Reguilón doesn't eat that. Sergio Aurier doesn't eat that. Even Eric Dier would have something a bit Portuguese. He does some bacalao or something. And it just sums up that he's just a average Joe footballer who somehow, because he doesn't fight with anybody, doesn't swear anybody, doesn't leave the stadium at halftime, he's just kind of survived through all of this. He survived through these dark days, and we haven't upgraded him. How? Because he's a nice guy and because he follows instructions, but he's just incapable of doing it.
I completely agree with that, and I think it's the following instructions bit that stands out there. It feels like the nutritionists have said, Ben, here's what you need to eat. You need to eat some boiled chicken, not fried, because that's unhealthy, and plenty of boiled vegetables, lightly boiled vegetables. So he sits down and he literally has a piece of boiled chicken and some boiled vegetables, no seasoning, nothing else.
They're not even steamed. They're just boiled. And they're all boiled at the same time. So you've got your carrots and your peas all being boiled at the same time. So there's not even a texture to them.
He's very dutiful. He's a very good boy. I mean, I think he gentle Ben, bless him. I think he probably has stayed at Spurs longer than many of us would have expected, because he is a good lad. He's not a problem, and he does follow orders. Nathan, I can see you're ready to chime in.
It's just reminding me that this is the diet of the strongest men in the world. Brian Shaw and like Eddie Hall, Hathi Bjornsson, they've all got YouTube channels as sort of their secondary careers, and they've all done like a what I eat in a day, and it's like 10 to 13,000 calories of boiled rice, boiled chicken, boiled vegetables. And yeah, obviously they're throwing in some spice and some stuff to give it some difference, but they're like, the lifting is the easy part. All of the weightlifting, that's a couple of hours of my day. That's the fun part. What my job is, what's hard, is eating this boiled mush for 12,000 calories a day. And I'm just thinking, that's what Ben chooses to have.
Bless him. So going away from his food choices briefly, Kenervo, another ex-sub, says, is Ben Davis good enough for being our second choice left back? I've been thinking since 16-17 season when Rose got injured that he isn't. What do you think, Nathan? Do you think he's good enough as a backup?
Probably, roughly. I think, he's an experienced head. You know his quality. He has some creative passing to his game. It's good to have like a defensive player, a more defensively orientated fullback as your second choice. I think there's a lot of reason that makes sense. He's solid. He's gentle Ben. You know what you're getting from him. Mm-hmm. And there's positives to that. Something even better than that might be you have an exciting young prospect to play back up and take those minutes. You know, the likes of Ryan Sessegnon, for example. There's nothing wrong. Like, Ben is good enough, definitely. It just might not quite be optimal. I think the fact that he can cover centre-back, or he's now being used to cover centre-back, helps with his utility and his usefulness to the squad. Yes, we could improve on Ben Davies, and yes, we could improve on the way that we use that space in the squad. But meanwhile, like, right back is on fire. Centre back has a great big hole in it. Central midfield is just beginning to stand up on it, like Bambi legs. So it's not my biggest concern.
Ryan Sessegnon, I had forgotten about him until I was watching yesterday, and I was just like, this would have been a pretty good game to throw Ryan Sessegnon in and play him as a left wing back, because, you know, and it's not like he can't learn from Reguilón. Reguilón's not a teenager. He's pretty experienced as well. He's a Spanish international, and you could have those two working together, and I think that would be great for our long-term future. It's just such a shame he's not there right now.
Well, Dennis Sirkin too, who I've got very, very high hopes for. I don't know his injury status at the moment. I do know that his dad very sadly passed away quite recently, and he's obviously going to be grieving his father, and you know that is a terrible thing to have happened to a very young man. And we don't know the circumstances around where Serkan is, but I've got high hopes for him at left back, and perhaps we'll see him before the season's out if Reguilon is out for a while. So following on from the Davis chat, we got lots of sort of similar messages, but more widely about the whole squad, essentially. So David Fleming, another email via the website, says, "When I heard the starting lineup for Spurs against Brighton, I cringed. Really, those players start for us. How could we think we will win with that starting lineup? How many Spurs players do you think would start on a top four side? I would say 5 to 6 players. Who do you think are those players, and who do you think doesn't start for a top four side?" And then likewise, in our X-Subs Discord channel, RR10 bumped a thread which was me saying that we have the second, third or fourth best squad in the league, saying, forgetting the top three now, which safe to say we can't match their squads, do we have a better squad than Chelsea? Even Leicester's squad could be better balanced than ours in defensive midfield. RR10 cites Davis, Doty, Sanchez, Sissoko, Winks, Lucas, Lamela, Vinicius, Hart and Bale as average squad players. And similarly, the silly man says, is it time to acknowledge that having a few truly world-class players has been masking glaring deficiencies in our squad for some time now? How can we start to fix this? Gosh. I mean, I still stand by it. I think all of those players listed are good backups. I think most Premier League teams, I mean, they would get into a lot of the Premier League teams, to be honest. And I still think we've got a strong squad. I really do think we've got a strong squad. But I'm interested in what you guys think. Bardi, where do you stand? Do you think we've just got too much deadwood?
I mean, for us, it always seems that all our squad players go in the worst funk at the same time. Lamela, Lucas, at the moment, can't do anything. I can't do anything correct. Squad-wise, like top-class players that started against Brighton, is the Sun, there's Schoenberg and then Ndombele. I think all the others struggle to get in a starting lineup of a top team. That's it. Those two. Those three. And then Kane is four. We have four top class players in our squad. The rest, they have their moments, but I think there's been a huge drop off in Alderweireld, in Lloris. Rodham looks okay, but that's just because he's alongside people who are inept. I thought our squad was better, but the squad players, they just don't seem to be working at the moment. And we saw that against Wickham. We had to throw in the big guys to win that game. There's been moments in the Europa League where we were away at Antwerp and away at LASK, where our reserve players, they've just shown that they're not there. I think we've overestimated how good our squad was.
I would add Reguilon to a list of genuinely top players as well. Yeah. And I would say I could make an argument that Lloris, Alderweireld and Lo Celso are all strong players in their positions. I mean, Alderweireld's absolutely declining, but I still think he's a very good Premier League defender. I think we struggle at right back. I think a partner for Alderweireld is an issue as well. But, you know, I don't think we're terrible. Nathan, where do you stand on this? Do you think, are we just not very good, essentially? Are our players not very good?
I think they're pretty good. We might not have Man City's squads or Chelsea's, you know, investment over the last summer.
Yeah, but 6 months ago, we might have been saying John Stones is rubbish. He wouldn't get in our side.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. The way that we, like, we always talk about the quality of players as if they're fixed values. And then those fixed values changed, and we say that this is the quality that player is, and we don't reflect. And like people say, oh, the players are playing badly, but don't look at the context of why that might be the case. Davies, yeah, we've just been saying, you know, a good squad player, certainly a good second choice left back. Doherty, I don't think he's been used very well. Might have overrated him defensively, but a lot of things are going wrong for him this season. It's slightly harsh to judge. Davinson Sanchez, a centre-back that we bought for £40 million, had a very good first season. Things have gone badly for him. I understand that. He looks pretty wobbly nowadays when he plays, but I think there's stuff going wrong there. Sissoko, obviously, spoken about a lot. I think that he's a very, very limited player. He's a very good runner, and that's about it. But Winks, you know, I think is a good squad player. Lucas, not a fan of, as we know, but Lamela, good squad player. Vinicius, I think, could be a really good second choice centre forward if he's coming off the bench regularly, if he's starting regular games. I think that's a good player there. Joe Hart, I think, is terrible. Gareth Bale, it's complicated. I there's still a player in there, and we saw that the other week against Wickham. Fitness is obviously a big issue for him. I think if he's coming off the bench imagine games in which we're, you know, 3-0, 3-1 up, and Winks comes on to join, not replace a midfielder, but to join midfield, and it's just they're knitting things together. Think of Lamella coming off the bench and being just high energy, fresh legs, because you can rest Sun now, and you're winning. I think you think much more positively about those players if they're not being relied upon to sort of do Harry Kane's job, because, okay, they're not Harry Kane, but I don't think they're bad players. I think it's a good squad. Yes, there are holes in the squad. Yes, there are gaps. Yes, there are issues at right back, to an extent at centre back. Central midfield is sort of coming to its feet now again, as I said before. But it's a good squad. The issue, there are issues within the squads, but you can play much, much better football with the squads than is currently being played with them.
Yep, for sure, for sure. So Sean Coe, who is an ex-sub, who actually designed our merchandise, check out our merch on theextraage.co.uk. Sean says, we are giving up so many crosses. Do you think our change of formation is an attempt to deal with that at all? Or are we inviting it more? We gave up 26 crosses against Brighton. And I need to reference as well that Jay Cowling 18, another ex-sub, put together some really useful data on crosses in the Premier League. And what it showed was that we were conceding roughly 25% more crosses than most of the teams we considered to be rivals. Or, well, rivals when we were actually looking like genuine top four contenders. Which is interesting, because it goes along with the theory I had that we look more dangerous. We look like we're more likely to concede goals from crosses because we face a higher proportion. And that certainly seems to be true from the data. But what do you think, Bardi? Do you think the 3-5-2 or 3-4-3 rather was an attempt to stop the crosses coming in?
I don't know. I'd like to see where those crosses were against Brighton, because they were able to work inside the gap between the full the wing back and the wide centre back and then pull it back. I don't know if that, they obviously it's a cross, but my concern is the ability for teams to get inside those spaces. Sané's goal, not Sané's goal, Firmino's goal from Sané's assist was
Mane. You've done what I used to do.
So that
Mane and Sané.
So that that goal came from the gap down the side of the centre back and the wing back, and Brighton's goal was the same. I just think flicking from a back five to a back to from back four to back five is hurting us at the moment. I think our inability, or Jose's inability, just to pick a formation and at least kind of work from there is hurting us. And yeah, before it was because we were dropping deep and just allowing teams to have the ball so they could swing it in at us, and we were relying on Dyer's big head to get us out of trouble. Now I think the crosses are a little bit more dangerous because they're being worked inside into more high risk areas. I think it's down to our defence, and I think it's once again down to our midfield. Højbjerg can only cover so much space. The poor guy he's running himself ragged trying to cover. And Ndombele, who has put pay to our kind of comments that he can't last 90 minutes. He run like a trooper against Brighton. He put in such a shift that, you know, he's properly trying for this. Either he's trying really hard to get out of there so someone comes and buys him, or he just really cares about the team. I thought he was the only player that deserves a pat on the back after yesterday.
I mean, I personally just don't think there was ever an issue with him completing 90 minutes. It just needed to happen. But, I mean, to be honest, I still think that if Lo Celso was fit, we would see Ndombele not playing 90 minutes. I really do. I think he'd still be making that same sub. He'd be bringing Lo Celso on for Ndombele after 60 minutes. But there we go. And that's kind of an aside. Nathan, I'll pitch this one to you. So this is from Alec Depkrinsky, who says, I've heard you mention before that you would like the squad rotation to be comprised of 15 to 16 first team players that can be plugged in and out of a lineup based on situation or opponent. I'm curious as to who would make it into your top 16 at the moment, assuming everyone in the books is fit. Also curious as to who Bardi and Nathan would have in theirs. So he's obviously writing it to me, because that was my comment, that my preferred form of rotation would be 15, 16, 17 players who can all play in any kind of interchangeable team rather than having an A team and a B team.
Yeah.
But it does bring about the point, who are those 15, 16 players? So we've got the first choice 11, which, you know, for us all, I would say, well, I mean, let's go through it. Lloris, Aurier, Alderweireld, Rodon or Tanganga at this point? Or would either of you go for Dyer?
Dyer.
You'd have Dyer. Nathan?
I'd probably go Roden at the moment, but, you know, it's close either way. There's your first sort of non-first 11.
There's your first backup. Yeah, one of those. Mm-hmm. Reguilón, obviously. For me, it would be a midfield of Lo Celso, Højbjerg and Ndombele.
Yep.
And then front line of Son, Kane and either Dele or Bergwijn for me.
I think so.
Seems pretty good. And then the backup options, I guess, would be, let's say, Roden, and we've got Dyer starting. I suppose you'd need to rotate the fullbacks because that's a position that requires a lot of getting up and down the flank. So you have Doherty and Davis. But then I wouldn't necessarily... Yeah, I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? You start going through and you're like, yeah, do I want Doherty to be part of my main rotation? But yeah, why not? Midfield, Sissoko. Up top, the other of Bergwijn or Dele, Vinicius. That's your core, isn't it? That's your...
Mm.
Have we missed anyone? I don't think we have. That's the core group. And I think that's solid. That's a good, solid core group of players.
Yeah, but there's enough there to play that way. But I think that, like, the reason we fall into this A and B is, again, going back to that lack of possessional structure. The moves that we put together are based on relationships between specific players, right? Mm-hmm. Son runs in behind because Kane drops off. As soon as Kane isn't Kane but is Vinicius, Son doesn't know how and when to time his runs and doesn't know if they're worthwhile to make at all. Højbjerg doesn't know if Vinicius is going to come towards him, and if Vinicius is just doing his best Kane impression, is that any good? Can he play the ball over the top? Essentially, because everything in attack is so improvised and is based on your previous relationships, you upset any one of those players, as we're seeing right now with Kane. Obviously, Kane is the king, is the key piece here. But I think even if it was Bergwijn, who was a dismissed player, I think even when we miss Bergwijn from our first 11, things aren't quite right. Things aren't quite the same when that player is Lucas or Lamella instead, and they aren't doing Bergwijn's behaviours of knitting things. They're trying to be more forceful because that's the nature of those two players. Well, we've lost games because Bergwijn's left the pitch, you know?
Yeah.
And that is why when you need to win a game, you play your full first 11, when you're Jose Mourinho. This is Jose Mourinho plays his best, all 11 of his best players, when it's a league game, when it's a major cup game. And because he has to do that, it means that when there's an opportunity to rotate, everyone's exhausted, everyone has to be rotated. So that's why I think we fall into this A and B trap, and we can't do an AB team and a BA team, right? You can't rotate two or three players here or there, or it's very hard to do that. It's because, everything comes crashing down or at least there's the potential for things to very easily come crashing down with just a couple of changes.
You've explained that really beautifully, Nathan. That's, exactly how I see it, but I couldn't have put it as well as you've just done there. And I think during the good times, so when we were on a good run, we were on a good run of results, and it felt like things were going in the right direction at one point earlier in the season. I think there would have been a way that we could have made some subtle changes, but you're right that Mourinho is so adamant that we cannot take off it off the gas. We have to win. He's kind of got himself into a bit of a pickle now. We don't have a plug-and-play system like Man City or Liverpool where you can play Jordan Henderson at centre-back and get away with it. You can, Gundogan has played like three or four different roles for Man City this season because that's the sort of flexibility the system allows. We don't have that. You're right. We've got this system which relies on individual specific skills. Harry Kane being able to bring a ball down effectively and hit one on the turn over the top for Son, who's making this immaculate timed out-to-in run. We don't have other players that can do those things.
I would just like to say that I agree with what you said, but there is a thing here. Relying on your best player to do something, to do a piece of magic, is not a problem. Sure. I do agree that because Liverpool was struggling against West Ham, what does Salah do? He cuts in and scores a wonderful goal with his left foot. Game opens up. So it's not a bad thing. Plenty of teams, every single team in the world does it, waiting for their best player to open up the game. But I do agree with you that we haven't had a philosophy of buying players who can do that plug and play, that universal USB thing that anybody can play in a role. Foden can come in and play a nine if he has to. He can play wide, he can play central. that is where I think that's where we fall down. If we take out Reguilón, our backup left back is completely different. If we take out Serge, Doherty is a totally different player. And I think that's where we've fallen down, is we haven't signed like for like. Kane doesn't play, so we put in Bale, and all of a sudden Bale is totally different. So we've had a plan A, and then we've gone plan B, but plan B is always, it's break in case of emergency. Our plan B isn't a helping plan A, and I think that's where we've fallen down. We've got so used to, we need something to come in for Kane that isn't Kane, that our whole team is like that. If Son is injured, we can't replace Son with Son, because Lamella, Dele, Bergwijn, they're not Son, and I think that's where our problem is. Had we a manager like Klopp or like Guardiola that is going to stick around and has the money as well to buy these players, then perhaps we could have seen something. Perhaps if Pochettino had been given that money, we could have seen something, but then we didn't. And that's the situation we're in now, that we can't chop and change. If Kane is out, we're fucked, because we don't have a Kane player to replace him.
It's a great point. And I think to take it on a step further, we're now in an awkward position where, you know, we know the squad was not built for this system. It's been adapted to this system. It was built on a possession-based system, so lots of them are ill-suited. But Daniel Levy's having his doubts now, I think, and so he's not going to start suddenly building towards a low-block and counter system. He's not going to say, yes, Jose, you can sell Ndombele and Dele, as he seemed to want to do at one point. I mean, probably for different reasons, but he said, no, you can't do that. Perhaps because he's got one eye on the future, Daniel Levy, and he's thinking, well, how long is Mourinho actually going to be here for? Particularly now we're playing, you know, looking so poor and the results aren't following. He's starting to go, well, do I really want to sell Dele or loan Dele with a view to selling him now when, God, Mourinho could be gone before he comes back? So it's a problem. We're sort of stuck between two styles, not just in the fact that the players don't know how to do what he wants to do, but also that he can't then buy players that do know how to do that. It's tough. I think we all know what the answer is, and it's fire Jose Mourinho.
Bardi, thoughts on that?
No, not yet. Let's beat Chelsea. If we beat Chelsea, the world would be all okay again.
I don't think we're beating Chelsea, mate.
Well, if we do, I'm going to... My manager's back. Otherwise, our manager has got some work to do.
Good. I mean, the next run of games is tough. It's tough for a team that's feeling a bit sorry for itself. So if we look at the fixture list, bear with me one sec. So, Chelsea at home. West Brom at home. West Brom's an interesting game because they've looked very patchy under Allardyce, but it's Allardyce. Everton away, who a bit up and down, but they've got all their key players back now. Then Man City away. Wolfsburg away, big game. West Ham away. I mean, West Ham look a very functional unit at the moment. Wolfsburg at home. Burnley at home. We've struggled with Burnley at the best of times. And then Palace at home. You'd normally expect us to beat Palace. We've got a pretty good record against them, but Christ, you fear it. And then Arsenal away.
You know what, man? I'm looking at the list of fixtures and... fuck it. I've really hit a turning point with this point. I am going to become the Joker. I think just full chaos. Let's lose a bunch of games and get it over with and rip the plaster off and from the ashes we can rise as the Phoenix and build anew. I can't keep going on just picking up results here and there with Jose Mourinho. Let's have it out.
Okay, here's a question for you. Is it, in fact, not all Jose's fault? It's our fault. So this is from Ollie Whitefoot, who sent his message via our website. Hi, guys. Are we, as a fan base, enablers? With all this talk of Dr. Tottenham and the Spursy negative self-preservation BS before games, do you think it filters through to the players in any way? I get that it's good to be able to be self-deprecating, but I'm so tired of seeing it. And Bardi, what do you think? Do you think Dr. Tottenham, sort of the mentality feeds in some way?
This is a really good question. Normally, I would say it does have an impact because I get fed up with the whole Spursy stuff, and you go into a game at home and you're thinking, we're gonna Spursy this up. And perhaps when the stadium was full of people, maybe there was something. Maybe the players could sense a tension in the crowd and they could feel the mood swing. But right now, football is played in a sterilised bubble. There is no effect from us. I don't know if the footballers, they barely look at social media. Well, they probably do, but it's very filtered for them as well. They're playing in a stadium where no one's there apart from their coaching staff. It should be like a training session where you're just completing your sequences of play. This is how we take this free kick, the throw-ins. So there's no outside effect here. This is like, I remember there was a Wimbledon final, and I think it was Federer against maybe Murray against somebody else, and it started raining, so they closed the roof.
Yeah,
and then that was it. The commentator said Federer wins this because all of a sudden there's no wind effect, there's nothing. It's a sterile environment, and the best team will win. And Federer just absolutely destroyed him. And that's what Tottenham should be doing now. There is no Spursy thing because there's no oh shit we're shitting ourselves. It's play football, win the game. So we're not enablers, no.
I agree. I think that's a really good point, buddy. Yeah. I do think that, like, the mentality of the fan base, the collective mentality of the discussed existence of conceptual Spursiness and our own sort of self-depreciating jokes about Dr. Tottenham, etc. I do think that has an effect on the team. But I also agree with Bardi that this season that is dramatically diminished by the lack of fans in the stadium. And also... also, we have in a manager whose entire thing is winning mentality, so what would it matter anyway?
Yep.
I was going to make that exact point.
Yep.
Yeah. But when the fans are back, I mean, we need to find our winning mentality as a fan base. Is that what you're saying?
I think maybe we could have an impact on the game. If Tottenham are playing low, we can maybe inspire the team, but I don't think so. You know, Stoke have really good fans, but look where they are. You know, this does happen like that.
Yeah. A couple of questions now about accountability. So first one from Josh Wilkin says, I wonder where you guys think accountability might lie for performances like the Liverpool game. I'm very much in the camp of there's still too much deadwood in the squad and there's only so much Mourinho can do with players like that. On the flip of this, some may argue that Mourinho has got good players at his disposal but he's deploying ineffectively. Where do you guys stand? And Michael Obi says, I have a question about Bardi's manager, the most pragmatic man in football. We've heard him hint that he's not confident in the defence. Individual errors leading to chances and goals has become a thing this season because the strategy is to soak up pressure, which puts a bigger burden on defence, which he doesn't trust. This isn't putting players into positions to have success, rather the opposite. So why does he insist on playing this way? So the issue of accountability is interesting after Brighton because Mourinho, I felt like he tried to do something different post-match. He tried to sort of say, no, we did okay. We played okay. We turned it round in the second half and we were playing some good football. And he seemed to sort of try to protect the players, which is something I've not seen him do for a while. Do you think there's a reason for that, Nathan?
We're all collectively losing our minds, him especially. I don't know. It's just like if he tells the reporter that we played well in the second half, that's what reports might read, and then there's slightly less pressure on his job. I think that's all it is. He's certainly not been afraid this season to put the blame on the defenders, and I think that like Alderweireld's block goes some way to sort of demonstrate the extent to which, not that there haven't been individual mistakes from defenders this season, not that there aren't issues with our defense, but like there's enough quality there that
he saved a goal.
There's enough quality between the defenders that we do have that we shouldn't be shipping a dodgy goal every single game, if not two.
And Bardi, respond to Michael, who has a question for you about your manager.
I mean, when we... Jose Mourinho was... I'm going to ignore the question, but it did make me think about Jose's career, and I don't think he's ever been able to turn the oil tanker. I think when things have started to slide, he's never been able to sort it out, and that's the worry that I have here. We've never seen him stop. It's always ended when things have gone bad. It's always ended with him walking away. He's never been able to right it. He's never been able to adapt, and that's the problem we have here. And that's why when I say I don't see how he fixes this, because history doesn't tell us that he can. The hope was that he was able to hold this together for the season and come out top four and win us something. Now I don't think, with Kane out, I don't think he fixes that. He hasn't got coronavirus coming to save him this time. Football's not going to get locked. He's not going. Well, I don't think football's going to get locked down. So that's my problem I have here. Of course, Mourinho, he won plenty of things when he had a good defence. Every team wins championships when they have good defence. But yeah, my concern is Mourinho turning this around.
You make an interesting point. I was in a meeting this morning with a Man U fan, and talk inevitably turned briefly to football. And I said how unhappy I'd been for some time. And he said, well, yes, the thing with Mourinho is that when things start to go bad, it just keeps getting worse. When I must admit, I mean, I do remember how toxic it got at Man U, but I wasn't paying sort of that much attention to them at the time. I guess because we were focused on our own achievements and what was happening at Spurs. But I hadn't quite picked up on the fact that he didn't sort of have any ideas to sort of turn them round. I didn't realise it had ended in that way. So yeah, it was interesting to hear that from a United fan.
It's an interesting one. Maybe one for me to look into is, has he ever arrested negative form? I'm sure there must have been dips at Real Madrid. There must have been. I mean, the thing with Real Madrid is one draw is a catastrophe.
Yeah.
But his first season in United, he finished sixth, and then he went on to finish second. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So does that count as arresting negative form? Or no, I think his first season, the archetypal Jose Mourinho cycle is first season is slightly underwhelming. He addresses two or three issues with heavy spending in the summer. He wins the league in his second season. And then the third season is the fallout. Whereas Spurs has not been anything even vaguely resembling that. It's just sort of been up and down and up and down and up and down. And the pandemic has thrown it about the place. And we're definitely not on your typical Jose Mourinho train, are we?
No. I did see a tweet that said it is, talking about Spursy, that it's proper Spursy for them to get Jose Mourinho and just skip straight to straight to the spiral and skip all the trophies.
This has been pretty downbeat, so let's try and end on a happy note. Happiness will return, won't it? I mean, I'm feeling. I think the thing is, I've been so sort of over this for such a long time now that I'm so far down that path. I'm just sort of. I feel like I'm actually closer to happiness now than I was a few months ago, if that makes sense, when everyone else was enjoying the run. I feel happier now because it's closer to coming to an end. I know that's awful. But yeah, I mean, we've got good players. We've got a good team. We've got an amazing stadium and setup that will sustain us for many, many years. We've got an incredible youth system. We've got a sensational set of youth players coming through. We've got Oliver Skipp and Troy Parrott to come back next year with a year of actual football under their belts. There's so much to be excited about for the future at Spurs.
Do you remember over the last 20 years of being a Spurs fan, and you would watch Manchester United fuck up and then they'd be fine the next season, and you'd watch Chelsea fuck up and you'd go, yes, this is it, they're going to collapse, and then they'd be fine the next season. You watch Arsenal throw things away and you think, yes, this is the end of Arsenal, and okay, maybe now maybe now that one's starting to go that way. But I think that's kind of where we are now. I think that we can fuck up. I think that we can have 2-3 dodgy seasons and we still fill out a 60,000 seater stadium and we still get the income out of that and we still end up in the Champions League pretty soon after and we can still balance the books. I think that we're too big to fail.
100% agree. The one thing that scares me is Harry Kane. That's I don't want to say the words because it's too depressing to even consider, but
I'm going to stop recording now.
Yeah. let's end on something that we've been enjoying recently. So Bardi, what have you been watching, reading, listening to anything that floated your boat recently? It's cheered you up.
I've been going back and, oh, I watched Bumblebee, by the way, the Transformers film, which was really, really, really good, surprisingly.
Is
good.
It? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Transformers, but I heard good things about it and it lived up to all of that. But I've been revisiting old TV programs, and I have a fallback TV show when things are going bad, when people are dying in real life or getting sick in real life. I always turn to 6 Feet Under, and the writing, acting, humour, and the way they cope with death and everything in that always kind of rights the ship. So 6 Feet Under, I've been enjoying that again.
Nice. I've never actually watched 6 Feet Under. It's always been on the list. I must watch it at some point. Nathan, how about you?
I've been watching a lot of films recently. A lot of films recently. But I don't know if there's like a specific And then, like, the thing is that, like, the show that I've been watching is a little obscure film, a little obscure TV show that some of you may have heard of called The Simpsons, which I don't think really, like, goes much the way of a recommendation. I've been watching seasons 2 to 8 of The Simpsons. So if you haven't checked those out yet and you are waiting on one positive recommendation, they're pretty good. They're, you know, the best series of television ever, will never be beaten. Are timeless, are ageless, are perfect, are short and sweet, or you can watch 12 in a row. The political messages from the 90s still stands, the societal messages from the 90s still stand, the characters are still brilliant. It's it's the perfect TV show. I don't know. So if you haven't checked out The Simpsons, now is the time.
Oh my god. Yeah, didn't expect that one, Nathan. He starts off by saying, I've been watching loads of films recently, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get some kind of quirky indie recommendation. Then he dropped The Simpsons. Buddy, was it you who recommended Peanut Butter Falcon?
Yeah, it was. And I just quickly...
I really like that.
He'll kill me because I never mentioned this. He always recommends TV shows to me and I always ignore him. And then 6 months later, I watch it and it's really good. And he's like, I told you, you're such a dickhead. But I watched Succession. My mate Sash has been after me for ages to watch Succession.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, 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 really fucking good.
It took me a little while. It took me a few episodes to get the sort of... the dry humour, the dark humour.
Yep.
And then when it clicked, oh my god, it's so... Tom is an outrageously good character.
Tom! Greg!
He's such a dickhead.
I love Greg. Greg is my favourite.
Greg. Yeah, man, it's a great show, Succession. I highly recommend that also. It's fantastic. I've been watching The Last Kingdom. I don't know if either of you have seen that. Originally it was a BBC thing.
Viking-y one.
Yeah, Vikings and beheadings and boobs. Okay. It's really enjoyable, and apparently it's not... So I spoke to a history professor who said it's not a bad representation of how things would have been, and the kind of fear that normal people lived in when their villages just got sacked. And then, you know, suddenly there were Saxons and Vikings being forced to live together and cooperate and get along. And he said it's not unrealistic. So yeah, I highly recommend it. It's good fun. Really good.
I would like to give one almost like extra inch warning to our listeners. Do not go and watch Death to 2020 created by the Black Mirror lot. It's terrible. It's horrible. It
looked
really
terrible from the trailer. Oof, I turned off trailers so because, like, I've been watching a lot of films recently, and it would, like, I'd watch this long, emotional film, and it would conclude with a beautiful ending, and then the credits would roll for 4 seconds, and then they'd start loudly blasting an advert for what looks like the worst documentary of all time. So I'm not surprised to learn that it was bad.
It's horrible. I would never finish it. I had big hopes for it. The cast is incredible. You know, it's done by the Black Mirror lots, but it's bad. It's so, so bad. It was worse than 2020.
Wow, that's some recommendation.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, D. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.